May it please the court.
You may proceed.
I don't intend to spend a lot of time entering into the discussion that the court has already manifested in the Legend Bank decision regarding severance, but I would like to make two observations regarding that topic. First, there are two approaches to severance. One of them is to look at the content or substance of a bill, the language of a bill, and take an objective or functional approach to deciding whether the rest of the bill can stand after a particular provision is severed. That's the approach taken in Hammerschmidt. That's the approach taken by the majority in Legends Bank. It usually leads to severance. I'd like to say almost always, that may be true, but it usually leads to severance. The other approach is to try and ascertain by some other means what it is the General Assembly would have done in some hypothetical world in which there was a different bill before it. A subjective or historical approach, not the approach taken in Legends, not the approach taken in Hammerschmidt, but the approach taken by the court below, which looked to whether the legislature would have passed SB 7 without Section B. The court ought to stick with the objective approach. Second observation. Here, the plaintiffs
Which of those is objective?
The objective one is you look at the language itself. You don't try and speculate as to what the General Assembly would or would not have done. And that's the approach that's mandated in the statute in 1.140 and the approach taken by the majority, but not by Your Honor's concurrence in Legends.
I notice she used the language both could and would in making that statement.
Yes.
And the test actually is would, even though at one place in your brief you referred to it as could.
I regret the imprecision.
But it is, would they have done it? What was their intention as opposed to did they have the ability to do it?
Yes, but the way in which the court answers that is by going and looking at the bill and saying, if we take this out, can the rest of the bill stand on its own? In Hammerschmidt, you look for the original controlling purpose. In Legend, the majority said we look at whether the provision is essential to the efficacy of the bill. And in this instance, Section B fails on both tests. The second observation goes to a rather astounding proposition in the respondent's brief. They say that it was sufficient to support the trial court's decision that SB 7 never passed without Section B. And that's right, it never did pass without Section B. That same statement could be made about every provision that this court has ever severed. In fact, that same statement could be made about every piece of legislation that ever passes the General Assembly. It's a little bit like saying you always find what you're looking for in the last place you look. Whatever the last version is, it didn't pass until that version. That approach would be the end of severance in the state of Missouri. Now let me turn to...
What about distinguishing, when we're looking at the statutory severance is intended to deal with substantive unconscionability. I mean, surely you recognize it's odd to me that we would presume that something passed in violation of the Constitution is on its face unconstitutional. And so we all sit here and we come to the plate with the idea that, okay, this is unconstitutional. Now what do we do with it?
But Your Honor,
why wouldn't we just... I understand why substantive severability applies to issues that are substantively unconstitutional,
yes.
Violate due process, equal protection. That makes total sense to me. But when right out of the starting gate, we understand that this provision is unconstitutional, why then would seven judges get to decide what part we like and don't like?
Your Honor, if I were wearing my law professor hat, next semester teaching state constitutional law, I might take that same position. But that would be a change from this court's consistent precedent. That it has its appeal. It does say to the General Assembly, we're going to police you very closely. But it also means that the moment that someone attaches the keys to the dome to any piece of legislation in the state of Missouri, that legislation goes down no matter what it consists of. And that is a result that this court has never, ever endorsed.
Can I ask just a simpler question? Why isn't the inclusion of the provision saying we would pass that all the provisions are severable, why doesn't that, if what they would have done without that provision is an issue. Why doesn't the specific inclusion in this bill, as opposed to simply the reliance on the general provision and the statutes, why isn't that a strong indication of what the legislature would do without that section, even if it's not an indication, even if it's irrelevant to the other two aspects of
it? It is a strong indication, but this court, to my chagrin, in this instance, has said that it wasn't ever going to feel bound by that kind of provision. But it is an indication. Okay. It is. Let me turn then to the questions this court has never addressed, novel questions regarding the relationship between the General Assembly and the governor. And I'm going to pose this hypothetical. January 2013, the General Assembly begins passing bills in January. And from January until May, every bill the General Assembly passes says, the effective date of, or the effectiveness of this bill is contingent on the enactment of SB 1000. Every one. And the governor, all through that term, has to sign every bill without knowing whether SB 1000 passes or what it consists of. And then at the very end of the legislative session, the legislature gets to say, okay, are we going to pass SB 1000 or not? And if we pass it, what's it going to have in it? Well, the plaintiff's argument here is that the General Assembly has the power to do precisely that, to make not just this bill, but every bill contingent on a bill that we don't even know what it is. Now, to get there, what they do is that they cite a series of cases in which there are contingencies. And we agree, there are cases and there, that endorse the idea that there could be contingencies in legislation. But there are four points that distinguish this case from those cases.
Excuse me, yes. Mr. Layton, but in this case, Senate Bill 8, which was the contingency, the text and the language of that bill was no.
Oh, no. No, I beg to differ. The text as of the day that the Senate that SB 7 was enacted was known, and the text, which may not have been the same the day the governor signed, was known, but the text according to whether it was ever passed was not known. In fact, think about this particular case. What the plaintiffs say is, until the last moment, Section B wasn't there. It changed at the last moment. No, it was not known, and it would never be known until it is actually passed. So that's one of the four things that distinguishes this from every single other case they cite. In every one of those, we know what the contingency is. It is defined in advance. Usually it's a public vote. It's defined in advance. Here we don't know what it is. We know what it is in the sense of its passage of SB 8 by this particular General Assembly in this extraordinary session, but we don't know what it consists of. Second, that in every one of those cases, the contingency is dependent on a third party, the people voting, a public official doing something, a particular set of facts. In none of those cases is it dependent on an action by the same General Assembly that is passing the bill. Third, that in every one of those cases, the action, the contingency, is something that will happen in the future, not something that would happen concurrently, that is, within a day or two or a few days of this particular event. And fourth, in every one of those cases, it's a specific provision. It is never the entire bill. I don't know where the line is beyond which the General Assembly can go in putting a contingency into a bill. But I'd ask this court to say that this is on the side of a line that at the very least says that the General Assembly cannot make an entire bill's effectiveness conditional on the enactment of another bill that is still pending before that same General Assembly, and then present that bill to the governor at the same time that they hold in their hands, the ability to decide whether the governor's signature has any impact at all. That's the problem with this particular approach.
Well, I assume your argument also extends to legislation that would be passed in future sessions as well.
Well, I think my argument may extend to that, but this court doesn't have to get that far. None of the cases that are cited would answer that question. They're all different than that, but this court doesn't have to go that far. In this case, we're talking about literally the governor being presented, having in his hand a bill that he has to sign. Okay, he only has 15 days, and they're still in session. So if they got out of session, he would know whether SB 8 had passed and what it consisted of, but they were still in session. So what we're talking about here is the unique instance in which they are still in session. They can still decide whether to pass SB 8 and what SB 8 will consist of.
And
that's the problem.
Is the reason that that's different is the single subject issue, or why is
Well, it's both the veto power of the governor, that is, the General Assembly is assuming it can veto the governor's signature, and because we have this same this single subject problem. And the plaintiffs think they can get out of that because it says there's a contingency. But we don't know what the contingency is. We know that it's passing of SB 8, but we don't know what SB 8 is. SB 8 can still change. And so at that point, we have a single subject clear title problem, but we also have a fundamental problem in terms of separation of powers.
Let me ask you a question about that in particular, because it seems to me that that you feel like it's a major concern to allow the legislature to basically usurp or take over the veto power of the governor in that argument. But at the same time, you want the court to be able to take over the governor's veto power and severance. So is the governor's veto power important enough to be protected from both of the other branches of government or not?
It is. The governor's veto power, I don't believe is implicated by severance because the governor knew, at least in this instance, exactly what he was signing. He actually issued a signing statement here said that.
Well, but there are lots of cases in severance, right, where he has to take the good with the bad, which is the same thing you're concerned about here.
Well,
and if we have severance, and if you leave it up to us to decide what stays and what goes, he might bank on the fact that we will sever the provisions that are offending to him, therefore not have to exercise his veto power, and therefore not be held accountable for the offending provisions the same way that the legislature would not be held.
I am confident the governors have done precisely that at various times.
I'm sure they have.
Thank you.
Thank you.
May it please the court, Steve Clark, Clark Law Firm, on behalf of the respondents. I'd like to begin with three brief points. Number one, we're asking this court to uphold and enforce Senate Bill 7 exactly as it was written and passed by the legislature and exactly as it was signed by the governor. Number two, it is the appellants who bear the burden of demonstrating that Section B of Senate Bill 7 clearly and undoubtedly violates the Constitution. We submit they have not discharged that burden. Number three, when it comes to severance, 2 points. First, the court has never allowed to stand the provisions of a bill, the passage of which was procured by a constitutional violation. Here, the appellants allege a constitutional violation that allowed the Senate bill, Section A of Senate Bill 7, to pass. And second, the court has always striven to uphold the legislative intent when it comes to severance. And here, the legislative intent couldn't have been more clearly expressed in the language of Senate Bill 7 itself. The legislature made very clear, abundantly clear, that it did not intend Section A to become effective unless and until Senate Bill 8 passed and was signed by the governor. So we know that intent. It's not so often that we have such a clear statement of the legislature's intent. So if the court gets to a severance analysis, if the court gets there, the court has to look at the language of the bill. And the language of the bill makes very, very clear what the legislative intent was. And to uphold the legislative intent, the court simply cannot sever Section B from Section A, because that would result in Section A becoming effective when the legislature made clear that it did not desire Section A to become effective unless and until Senate Bill 8 passed. A couple of responses to some of the points that Mr. Layton makes. Mr. Layton claims that when engaging in severance by looking at the General Assembly's intent, the court would have to speculate. But as I say, Senate Bill 7, Section B of Senate Bill 7, makes very clear the court doesn't need to speculate at all. Their intent was abundantly clear. Mr. Layton also says, well, the court cannot do away with severance because the legislature has come to rely on that. I would submit that the court has put the legislature on notice before the special session of 2011 in this court's unanimous opinion in Prestige Travel, in which the court stated very clearly that there may come a time, and that may be very soon, that the court needs to examine whether to sever because of the issues with the separation of powers that severance creates. And I think we have that here. Mr. Layton claims, and the appellants claim, that the Senate Bill 7 violated the governor's veto authority. The governor was free to veto Senate Bill 7 from the get-go. In fact, there were days left in the session, as appellants concede. The governor could have vetoed Senate Bill 7 with the contingency, stated an objection to the contingency, and sent it back to the legislature. If they could have passed it without the contingency, then the bill would have come back to the governor's desk. If they could not have passed it without...
Well, they argue the difference here is that no provision of the law would take effect upon the governor's signing of it, which is the way the Constitution is set up. It's all contingent on whether a separate bill would pass. Therefore, the governor's signature does not make the bill become effective. That is different than the prior cases you cited.
Understood, Your Honor. However, that argument of appellants is incorrect. Mm-hmm. Senate Bill 7 became law when the governor signed it. It came into effect on January 25, 2012, 90 days after the special session ended. And what was the effect of that? The effect of that was that Section B, which became effective that day, rendered Section A ineffective.
And why were the bills not simply in a single bill? Why were they in two different bills if one could have no effect without the other?
They started out together, Your Honor. The provisions of Senate Bill 7 were included in the original version of Senate Bill 8 introduced in the special session. Why they were separated, that's truly a matter of speculation, I would have to say.
Well, would it be the issue that, in part, that they would violate the single subject requirement and that this, in effect, by attempt to get around that, by separating them in two bills, but making them dependent on each other as if they were in one?
Your Honor, I would say no to that because both of the bills at their core had to do with economic development. And we know that based on both the text of the two bills and based on the text of the governor's proclamation. And now the governor's proclamation is no idle document. It's a document that is required by the governor to issue, required by the Constitution for the governor to issue to set a special session. So we know the bills were tied together as part of one package. And in that regard, it makes this case somewhat similar to the Illinois case we cite, Wirtz v. Quinn, in which there were four bills that were all part of the governor's economic development or tax package in that case and in that state. And that's a case where the contingency, contrary to what appellant's counsel argued, was part of the same legislature and in the same session of the same legislature. So what was done there, in effect, was done here. So, too, with the Florida case we cite in our briefs, Galdon v. Kirk.
Do you concede that the trial court ruled contrary to prior Supreme Court precedent?
No, Your Honor. I think the trial court ruled consistent with prior Supreme Court precedent.
Well, he relied on a concurring opinion that was not the majority opinion.
The trial court did rely in part on Judge Fisher's concurring opinion in Legends Bank, but I think the trial court faithfully applied the Hammerschmidt test. And the Hammerschmidt test is, would the bill have passed but for the constitutional violation?
Well,
unanimously, this court has always applied the beyond a reasonable doubt standard as to whether or not legislation would have passed.
That is correct, including within Legends Bank. The court cited
the majority opinion of Legends Bank even restated the test, which was in Hammerschmidt, that you would have to demonstrate that it would have passed beyond a reasonable doubt.
Indeed. And in Legends Bank, the court relied on and cited the Hammerschmidt case and the Prestige Travel case. And the court's opinion there was consistent with those cases. And certainly we can tell that the there was no signal in the opinion of a change in the law in that regard.
But actually, you're only looking at part of the sentence. The language from those cases states that the provisions of the statute are so essentially and inseparably connected with and so dependent on the void provision that it cannot be presumed the legislature would have enacted the valid provisions without the void one. So you cited the end of the sentence correctly, but you've not cited the beginning of the sentence about the connectability and the inseparability elements of both provisions A and B.
Well, to that, Your Honor, I'd say that the both the trial court and we look at that in the sense that the Section B was, Section A was dependent and inseparable from Section A because the two were connected in that Section A, it's clear, would not have passed without Section B.
But how are they connected subject-wise? I mean, I think that's what the law and our president's estate is, that the elements of the language has to be connected,
well, that,
intertwined or interrelated.
Well, that is one way the court has looked at it, a function test, as appellant's counsel called it. But the court has also looked at an effects test. What is the effect if we remove a provision of the bill and essentially lop it off like a tumor and say, what's the effect on the rest of
it? Would it be able to stand on its own?
Would it be? Well, but not just functionally, but what is the effect from a legislative
standpoint?
But
how do we determine what the legislature meant other than by what they said?
Well, I think, Your Honor, that's my point exactly. We determine what the legislature meant exactly by what they said, and what they said was they didn't want A to become effective unless and until Senate Bill 8 passed.
And what did they mean in subsection 5 when they said that if any provision of the bill is held to be invalid, it shall not affect the other provision?
Well, Your Honor, I would submit that provision was in the bill from the very get-go. It was in the beginning. It's a boilerplate severability clause.
So anything that's been in the bill a long time we should ignore and anything new we should pay attention to?
Well, on the facts of this case, Your Honor, I'm not suggesting that that be the bright-line rule, but on the facts of this case, I think it's clear that that's what we should do because the Senate bill, the Section B, was only added at the very end to get it across.
When they added in B, they didn't make an exception to 5 other than B, which they could have done if they wanted the whole thing to be contingent on B. B somehow had greater import and was determinative. They could have said up to Section B, but they didn't. They said it's all contingent. And you're asking us to speculate, aren't you, that they really didn't mean what they said?
Well, I don't think so, Your Honor. And I'm asking the court to look at Section B and look and say that they meant exactly what they said in Section B. But also, I think we can presume that the legislature is aware of this court's jurisprudence, that the court does not give heed to self-inserted.
I'm looking at the case here, and it doesn't say we ignore what they said. It says, if by striking out a void exception, the remainder by reason of generality will have a broader scope as to subject or territory, its operation is not in accord with legislative intent. In effect, it's a restating that you can't really separate it out without from the whole. It's not saying we ignore all these. It says you look at them and see if, in effect, you can give an effect to the legislative intent. And if you can't, then you can't be bound by the fact that the legislature didn't intend it.
Well, I agree that in Chrysler v. Calcaterra, the court did not say you give those no effect ever in any circumstance, but the court has made clear in subsequent cases that these so-called self-inserted severability clauses are not dispositive in cases where there's a procedural violation of the Constitution, as here.
Even where on the issue of what the legislature intended, as opposed to the other issues about whether it can stand alone or whether they're so interrelated, where, of course, the legislature's intent wouldn't change those facts. But if the issue we're looking into is what the legislature would have done, why don't we look to what they told us they would have done?
Well, I would submit the court should, and that the court should look at Section B. And the legislature told us very clearly what they would and would not have done and what they did and did not intend. They did not intend for Section A to become effective unless and until Senate Bill 8
passed.
And
what did they intend if we were to find, and I know you're going to address that Section B was unconstitutional?
I think, Your Honor.
Don't we look to Section 5 for that? I'm not clear why we shouldn't look for Section 5. And
well,
I'm not hearing an argument other than your interpretation of the earlier case, but as a matter of policy, explain it to me?
I would say two things. One, as a matter of precedent, and two, as a matter of policy. As a matter of precedent, the court has always looked at the so-called severed provisions or the offending provisions as well as the remainder of the bill. For example, in Trout v. State, for example, in Legends Bank, for example, in Hammerschmidt v. Boone County.
In Hammerschmidt, which created the doctrine of severance, it applied the beyond a reasonable doubt standard, and it did not sever, correct?
Correct. And in fact, Hammerschmidt started from the presumption that when there is a procedural violation of the Constitution, the court presumes that the entire bill is unconstitutional. Started from that presumption.
Isn't our job, as Justice Scalia once said, to interpret laws rather than to reconstruct legislative intentions?
I would agree with that, Your Honor, yes.
Well, then why are we looking at what the legislature intended to do, or you know, what amendments passed and what form the bill was in when it passed?
And I would submit the court does not need to do any of that. The court simply needs to look at Section B. And the legislature's intent is very clearly set forth in Section B. The legislature did not want Section A to become effective unless and until Senate Bill 8 passed. So I don't think we have to look beyond that at all.
And can we reach the conclusion you're asking us to reach and give effect to the language in subsection 5 regarding what their statement concerning if a provision is held invalid?
I think that the court can, under precedent, yes, the court cannot look at or find that.
Can we consider that provision because it is there as evidence of their intent and reach the conclusion that you're asking us to reach?
I think the court can, because I think the court then needs to also look at Section B and consider the intent of that, and look at Section B as a later added on provision, or a later amended provision to Section A. And Section A had a boilerplate severability clause.
Do you have case law that supports it? Because normally we are compelled to read the entirety of the bill in context and not consider how it passed through the legislature. Do you have case law that allows us to look at when it was amended and how it was amended as a basis for interpreting it?
Yes, Your Honor, and as I say, the Hammerschmidt itself, Trout v. State, the court looked extensively at the way in which the bill came through the legislature, and its journey through the chambers, if you will, or its progression through the chambers. And also in Hammerschmidt, Legends Bank, I would note that four of the first five paragraphs of the Legends Bank opinion, the court details the journey of that bill, or the series of bills in that case, through the legislature, and that court has routinely done that.
Did it do that to determine that it meant the language of the bill meant something different than what it was at the end, or did it consider that journey when there was no indication expressly what the legislature intended?
And I think in the Trout case, the court did exactly that. The court considered the journey and the intent in that situation.
But just to understand, so you're saying, for instance, with the keys to the Capitol provision, the result of severance would be different depending on if that was added in at the end of the process or if it was in there at the beginning?
Well, remember that Legends Bank was an original purpose case, not a single subject rule case. So there is a difference there in that situation, Your Honor. And the timing, the court would have to look at it a little differently because the tests are applied at different times. Single subject rule is applied in the bill as passed, whereas original purpose, the court looks to the bill as introduced. So, yes, there is a temporal difference based on the two tests.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Actually, there were multiple subject claims in Legends Bank as well as a change of purpose. Just a couple of points. Counsel began by saying something like, the court has never allowed by severance to stand provisions of a bill passed in violation of the procedural requirements of the Constitution. If he'd said the court hasn't done that since Legends Bank in February, that would be a correct statement.
The rest of his sentence said, against clear legislative intent. The rest of this quote.
It said what? I'm sorry, I couldn't hear you.
In opposition to clear legislative intent.
And I missed that when I wrote it down, and I disagree there's clear legislative intent. Let me turn just in a moment here to this question of reasonable doubt. The phrase used by the trial court and used by this court. The question, assuming the court decides to retain that formulation, is not whether you look for reasonable doubt, it's reasonable doubt as to what. You know, when I was considering argument, I thought that I'd read in the plaintiff's brief that they'd said what Judge Fisher said earlier, which is it beyond reasonable doubt that the legislature would have passed this if it didn't have the offending provision? But they don't say that. And the reason that they don't say that is because this court has never said that. Go back to Hammerschmidt, where we first get the phrase. The entire bill is unconstitutional unless the court is convinced beyond a reasonable doubt, not that the legislature wouldn't have passed it. Convinced beyond a reasonable doubt that one of the bill's multiple subjects is its originally controlling purpose and the other subject is not. Well, that isn't whether it would have passed it. That's a question that we can ask, and because there is a change of purpose question there, we can ask by looking at the original purpose as well. Look at Legends.
When you look at the single subject cases, they've applied that standard differently, though, right? The single subject cases have applied whether or not the other subject matter would have passed. So that's the difference. I mean, all three of these are different temporally. They have different analysis. Oftentimes, the challenges come with all three because the legislature has decided to violate all three constitutional provisions in the same passage of the same bill.
Assuming that single subject and clear title are separate ones, there are three, and yes, we are used to hearing cases in which all three are something's challenged on all three bases.
But didn't we state in Legends that unless this court is convinced beyond a reasonable doubt that the specific provisions in question are not essential to the efficacy of the bill?
That's exactly what the court said. Again, the question is reasonable doubt as to what? And in Legends Bank it was, unless it's beyond reasonable doubt that they are essential to the efficacy of the bill. That's the question. Was Section B essential to the efficacy, the effectiveness, the ability to implement SB 7, and it was not. Thank you.